Sai's glory, his divine story. Every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Praising the Divine Mother, her glory and effulgence, and offering myself at her lotus feet, this is Karuna signing in live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. Good morning, dear listeners, and Holy Navratri to you. Welcome to Morning Glory on Thursday, October the 10th, 2013. It's 9:44 a.m. here in Prashanti Nilayam right now, and the current temperature is 24 degrees Celsius. We are experiencing lows of 23 degrees at night time and daytime highs of about 30 degrees Celsius. General outlook for the day: generally cloudy and quite breezy due to the cyclone brewing far away in the Andaman Sea. Serving the ashram and all its allied institutions this week are the Sevadal volunteers from the Indian states of Bihar and Jharkhand. Currently, Prashanti Nilayam smack in the middle of this divine week of prayers, sacrificial yagnas and intense Vedam chanting. And in the evenings we have amazing scholarly expositions on the significance of this festival and some soul-edifying musical presentations. Meanwhile, Baba's students are busy visiting village after village, delivering Swami's prasadam and beautiful new clothes to the villagers at their doorstep as part of their experiential learning called Gram Seva. All the divine traditions that Baba had started are continuing and growing with each passing day. Just listening to the Vedic chants in the Purnachandra auditorium every morning and watching the flames of the yagna leap up and consume the various items of sacrifice being offered is a sight for gods to behold. The energy is so high that one can feel its vibrations pulsating through the bloodstream by just sitting there quietly and taking it all in. Of course, Bhagwan's beautiful blue and silver throne with the silver umbrella is placed on the stage as he is the Veda Purusha accepting all our prayers. The festival of Navratri is being celebrated very elaborately here as it always has been, and it has one single aim, and that is to pray for world peace. The greatest miracle is that everything is going on smoothly in our divine ashram despite the severe power cuts and other disruptions that we have had in this part of Andhra Pradesh due to a political agitation. Truly, no one and nothing can come in the way of Bhagwan's Vajra Sankalpa or his divine will. Despite the long power outages, Swami has allowed us to keep going on with our programs and live feeds with the help of backup power. Today on Morning Glory, I have lined up an eye-opening discussion, let's call it a panel discussion or a study circle, on the significance and relevance of this festival of Navratri. I learned so much from it, and I'm quite sure so will you. It provides great insights into why we do what we do during these 9 days. I assure you that you will love listening to these wise women and their explanations. Apart from self-learning, I would recommend it very highly for study circles and SSC and Balvikas teachers. This will be followed by part one of a brand new episode of Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories. Under the spotlight today is Sai University alumna, Mrs. Yogini Suvarna of Mumbai. I will bring you the remaining two parts of this interview with Mrs. Yogini Suvarna right here on Morning Glory over the next 2 weeks. So, dear listeners, let's begin Morning Glory with a discussion on Navratri and then enjoy part one of the Fleeting Moments interview with Yogini Suvarna, and I will play both these programs for you back to back. Now, given the power cuts we are experiencing and our dependence on backup power, prudence demands that we avoid taking undue risks. So I beg your indulgence to sign out right now. That way we can avoid putting any undue pressure on the available power supply by keeping the studio too busy. But you stay tuned to this very special Navratri episode of Morning Glory that we have prepared for you, and enjoy every minute of it. This one is dedicated to the Divine Mother. May her bountiful blessings fill your lives with peace, harmony and happiness. Sai Ram, and happy listening to Morning Glory.
Sairam, dear listeners, Prashanthi Nilayam is currently celebrating the Navratri Festival 2013 as per the grammar of the Vedas, in exactly the manner that Bhagwan prescribed. Elsewhere, across the rest of India also, the festival marks community and family worship of the feminine aspect of divinity. And it is celebrated with big pandals, those are huge tents where the goddess is worshipped with much fanfare during these 9 days. The celebrations typically include worship, live music, dances, food, and sometimes even little craft bazaars. With Navratri, the goddess has arrived. But the question becomes, have you? While we place the goddess on a high pedestal during the 9 days of Navratri, where does she go for the rest of the year? Do we relegate her to the back of our minds or even abuse her as she walks, talks and interacts with us in many forms all the time? Does the goddess not live within each one of us? And by each one, I mean every man and every woman. India, the land that worships God as the feminine energy, is also, very sadly, the unsafest place in the world for women today. Crimes against women are on the rise. The issue of female infanticide continues to cause serious social imbalances, and the girl child is still malnourished. Female mortality rates are dismal. Dowry deaths, wage disparity, and the brutal violation of women's dignity seem to have become the order of the day. Does the situation justify our worship of the Divine Mother with pomp and gaiety during the Navratri festival for a 9-day period and then abuse of the female form for the rest of the year? Today we have a panel of Bhagwan students, three outstanding ladies who are all Sai University alumni, and we hope to explore with them the topic of worshipping the Devi beyond Navratri. And it is now my pleasure to introduce the panel to you. Dr. Ms. Sharda Subramaniam is an Associate Professor, Department of Philosophy at the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, Anantapur Campus. Her area of specialization is Existentialism and Western Philosophy. Incidentally, dear listeners, Dr. Subramaniam completed her Master's in Philosophy from the Sai University, and she happens to be my classmate and my roommate from Anantapur days. Obviously, we have a very lucky girl in the studio today, but I'm not saying which one of her she is.
Sairam Karuna.
Sairam, and welcome to Radio Sai Sharda. Our next panelist is Mrs. Nirmala Shekhar from Singapore. Nirmala Shekhar is also an alumna of the Sai University Anantapur campus and a mother of a current Sai University student. Winner of the 1984 All-Rounder Gold Medal from Bhagwan Baba, Nirmala Shekhar is quite an overachiever with a BCom degree from the Sai University, a Master's in Computer Applications from Bombay University. She is also a graduate of the Cost and Works Accountants of India, and she now devotes herself to the Sai mission, especially Sathya Sai Education in Human Values. Sairam Nirmala, and welcome to Radio Sai.
Sairam Karuna, thank you for giving us this opportunity.
Thank you for joining us today. Our third panelist is currently a doctoral research scholar of the Sai University Anantapur campus, Ms. Lalita Sarma R. Lalita's area of research is very interesting indeed, feminism and gender studies. Earlier on, she completed her master's in English from the same campus. Sairam, Lalita, it is great to have you on the show.
Sairam, ma'am.
Ladies, on your behalf and mine, I pray to Bhagwan Baba to think and speak through all of us as we explore the true significance of the Navratri festival and its relevance to our lives through this study circle on worshipping the Devi beyond the Navratri. Let's start with Lalita Sarma. Lalita is a young lady growing up in the 21st century India, and as a scholar who is researching the sensitive issue of feminism and gender studies, what is your take on the status of women today?
When we look at the position of women in today's world, we find that it's got a great ambiguity. We treat it on one hand women as deity and on the other hand women as a commodity. Often women are treated as objects. Even the portrayal of women in films or mass media are sometimes highly offensive, and violence against women's dignity and honor is on great rise. And this violence against women is often perpetrated at different levels, sometimes even epistemic violence. Any extent of lawmaking or even law enforcement is quite inadequate to confer fundamental human status such as respect and dignity. And I think gender sensitivity is a very crucial component of values that must be integrated in childhood itself. And Swami has stressed that modesty, chastity and humility are the crest jewels of womanhood. Swami says it in the Dharma Vahini. So therefore, women, being such repositories of virtues, must also conduct themselves with great care. If women realize that there is divinity inherent in them, they will naturally conduct themselves with great dignity. And this Navratri festivities is a very holy time dedicated to the worship of the Shakti or the feminine aspect. And I think it's the most opportune time for us to introspect and set right our mindsets. Navratri is a festival of affirmation of the feminine energy to counter the mutilation of the women power that often happens. Recently we had this abuse of goddess campaign that we found in the mass media.
It was very popular. It became viral on YouTube and it evoked very mixed reactions. People were very highly offended that their goddesses looked abused.
Yes, because in India we are so sensitive when it comes to the goddess, and this duality of worshipping woman as deity and abusing woman as a commodity that got juxtaposed with this theme. So I think Navratri is the most appropriate time for us to evoke the feminine energy within each of us.
That's a very pleasant perspective from a young person like yourself. Now let me turn to Dr. Sharda Subramaniam. What's the significance of Navratri?
Coming to the significance of Navratri, we celebrate this festival twice a year. Every year, the beginning of summer and the winter are two very important junctures of climatic change and solar influence. So these two junctures have been chosen as a sacred opportunities for the worship of the divine power. There are two very reasons for this particular way of worshipping twice a year, that is Vasant and Sharad Navratri.
And one coincides with spring and the other with fall.
So they're
both cusp periods when there's a change in the weather systems.
Exactly. The two important reasons for such a kind of a belief is, number one, the belief is that it is divine power which provides energy for the earth to move around the sun, causing the changes in the outer nature, and therefore, this divine power must be thanked for maintaining the correct balance of the universe. Secondly, due to the changes in the nature, the bodies and the minds of the people undergo a considerable change, and hence, we worship the divine power to kind of bestow upon all of us enough potent powers to maintain our physical and mental balance. So thereby, the Navratri celebrations are devoted to the worship of Eternal Mother, which has its origin in the Vedas. Durga, who is considered to be a combination of the Trinity of Goddess. She is the Saraswati aspect, the Parvati aspect, and the Lakshmi aspect. So during Navratri, all the three main goddesses are worshipped. However, I feel the central theme of Navratri is the triumph of good over evil.
I never ever thought that it actually established our connection with nature so closely, as you pointed out, that nature and us, the cosmos, we're only a limb of the same big fabric or this big, huge network of life force. So when there's a change in the weather system, there's a change within us as well, and we need to take that time to worship ourselves.
Incidentally, woman is considered closer to nature, and nature itself is considered to be feminine.
Yeah, because we say mother nature. We never say father nature.
Yes, and you have that Purusha Prakriti dual aspects also.
Very, very interesting insight. Now, what's the deal with the name? Why do we call it Navratri? Navratri literally means nine nights. So there must be a deeper significance.
Yeah, you're right. Swami has given a deeper significance to this. His Navratri literally means nine nights. And Swami says there are nine grahas, or the planets according to the astrology. And these have a great influence on human mind as well as the nature outside. And it is found that all the mankind is dependent on these planets, the movement of these planets around the solar.
But Swami very often said that what can grahas do if there is anugraha? So divine grace, anugraha means divine grace, and this divine grace is very important.
And I think that does away with our dependence on astrology and all our phobias that, you know, my certain planet is not in the right house and I need to do this. So Swami gave us that assurance that we can overrule the destiny chart the planets have for us as long as we have His grace.
Ah, you're right. Swami beautifully brings an analogy. He says, take an expired medicine bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Medicine is within the bottle, but then it doesn't have power. The power is vanquished. So similarly, though the consequences of our karmic deeds still exist, Swami's grace can just put them all off, and thereby we can cross over this hurdle of, you know, facing the consequences. And that way Swami's grace helps us get over the tide of the consequences of karma.
And the nine planets.
That's true.
During the Navaratri.
And that is true.
Dr. Subramaniam, why is it that we often refer to this God self as the mother?
You're right. Generally, mother always is associated to divine power and not the father aspect. Because there is a belief that God's glory, His cosmic energy, His greatness and supremacy can be best depicted in the motherhood aspect of God. For example, just as a child finds all these qualities in his or her mother, all of us look upon God as mother. This is one of the reasons why Hinduism gives so much of importance to the mother aspect of God, because we believe that mother is a creative aspect of the absolute. In fact, everything in this universe originates with this mother nature.
Very well said. Thank you for that. Now, traditionally we worship Goddess Durga for the first 3 days of the Navratri, and then for the middle three we worship Lakshmi Devi, and finally the last 3 days of this 9-period celebration are dedicated to Goddess Saraswati. Nirmala Shekhar, let's talk about the three goddesses in detail. What can you tell us about them?
Karuna, Swami has explained this very beautifully. Swami says that Mother Durga gives us energy.
Mm-hmm.
Physical energy, mental, intellectual and spiritual energy. And Mother Lakshmi gives us wealth. We often think that wealth is just money or, you know, dollar signs or rupees. But there's more to wealth than just money. Swami talks about wealth as being food, good nutrition, health is wealth. And Swami talks about the wealth of character and also intellectual wealth. Mother Saraswati gives us intelligence, the capacity for intellectual inquiry and discrimination. She's also called Vak Devi, the goddess of speech. She represents and gives us the capacity for music and all fine arts. We have many stories that depict Durga as a ferocious goddess with terrible, fearful form, and small children are sometimes afraid to see the form of Durga. And Swami says Durga is not to be understood as a ferocious goddess. She is the goddess that protects you. And as we were looking at Durga, Lakshmi and Saraswati, a beautiful analogy of a piece of land will help us understand the role that each of the goddesses play in our lives. If we take the analogy of a piece of land where we want to grow something, what is the first step that we would undertake? The first thing that we would do is to construct the boundary, you know, put up a fence so that other outside animals do not come and encroach on the land.
Or your neighbors.
Or the neighbors as well. Strangers as well.
That's true.
And the next thing that we would do is clear the land of all the weeds. And generally people say destroy the weeds. But when we look at farming practices, it's not destruction. It's transformation of the weeds into fertilizer or compost. So that's the next step. We would remove all the impediments to the growth of the plants in the land. Swami says Mother Durga gives us energy. How does she give us energy? She gives us energy by removing our negative qualities. Removing the negative qualities, not by destroying them, but by transforming them into positive ones. So that is how Mother Durga gives us the energy. All of this is done under the umbrella of the boundary. And the boundary gives us a safe place, a secure place to grow. The boundary also defines our identity, and that is very important because this identity allows us to grow under the safe umbrella of the boundary.
I think it's a very important point because redefining oneself is all about, you know, establishing boundary values. It's a very significant point, I feel.
And I think women's boundaries are constantly changing.
Yes, because you constantly keep doing role plays. And sometimes the transition is very permanent. For example, it's like a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. You can't revert back. It's beautiful transformation, of course. That's a permanent stamp. So redefining oneself is something that's so integral to a woman's life.
And I don't think women redefine themselves in a linear manner because there are times when within a course of a day you redefine many roles. You may be a professional woman one moment and you may be a homemaker another moment and a mother and a daughter-in-law and a daughter or a sister-in-law, all within the span of maybe a 24-hour cycle.
True, true.
So I think the concept of Durga, defining the boundaries, is very relevant to our lives.
Boundary also has significance because women as nurturers generally overextend themselves.
Oh, typically they do, yes.
So knowing our boundaries is very important for our growth and nurturing ourselves as well, along with nurturing others. So Mother Durga empowers us. Swami doesn't like the use of the word empowers because traditionally we understand empower as power coming from outside. Mm-hmm. Somebody is transferring power to us.
Yes, I see.
My understanding of the word empower is something to do with educare in that true power is already within us, but there are impediments for the free flow of the power from within us. So Mother Durga empowers us by removing all these obstacles, all these impediments, all the negative qualities, so that our own innate power can just flow from within and come out. And that's how I see the role of Mother Durga in our lives. Swami also talks about Ichha Shakti.
Mm-hmm.
Ichha Shakti is the energy of willpower or determination. And Swami says that Mother Durga embodies Ichha Shakti, the energy of determination and willpower. I had a beautiful dream a few years back, and that explains the concept of Ichha Shakti very beautifully to me. In the dream, Swami was conducting a Balvikas quiz, and the Balvikas students were 7 and 8 year olds, and they were all collected in the mandir, and Swami was the quiz master, and he was asking the questions. And the very first question that Swami asked is, what is the first step to doing anything? And as I'm observing, I saw a small boy, probably a 7 year old, got up. And very spontaneously and very confidently, he said, Swami, confidence is the first step to doing anything.
Hmm.
And before Swami could acknowledge, the entire audience started applauding and assuming that this is the correct answer. Swami waited patiently. Everybody's applause died down. And then Swami said, no. Wanting to do is the first step to doing something. And Ichha Shakti is that wanting to do something. That precedes every action. Mother Lakshmi embodies the nurturing aspect within us. And if you look at the example of the analogy of the piece of land,
mm-hmm.
once the land is ready to be sown and all the weeds have been cleared, the next step would be to start planting the seeds. And when we plant the seeds, we need to provide the seeds with the right nutrients and the right ingredients for growth. These would be the sunlight, the water, the fertilizers, and Mother Lakshmi provides the wealth of all these.
Mm-hmm.
She also embodies Kriya Shakti, which is the energy of action. We have the energy coming from Durga, but really there's no point in having energy if you're not going to translate it into action, and Mother Lakshmi gives us that impetus to action, doing the right action. Moving on, Mother Saraswati represents the creative aspect. Once the seeds have been planted and we have provided the right ingredients to the seeds and the plants, the next step would be the blossoming of the flowers and the ripening of the fruits. This is the time when our own creative abilities blossom from within us. This is also the aspect of Jnana Shakti, which is the energy of intelligence and wisdom.
And all these Ichha Shakti, Jnana Shakti and Kriya Shakti are there within us, isn't it? And I just happen to remember these lines from Tagore's Gitanjali when he says, "Hidden in the heart of things, thou art nourishing seeds into sprouts, buds into blossoms, and ripening flowers into fruitfulness." So he's the prime mover, the Shakti within each of us.
Very beautifully said, Lalita.
And you know, this analogy of land that you draw a boundary around, pull out the weeds, get the soil prepared, and then sow and reap a harvest and so on. It also reminds me of the fact that all the three devis are operating all the time, obviously, within us. For example, today the study circle, the universe was almost against it because given the fact that there is so much of political turmoil in Andhra Pradesh, there was no power to record in the studio. And then we established our boundaries. We decided who will specialize in which aspect of the discussion. And we cleared the way by making sure that we overcame the obstacles of the lack of power. And then we had the will to go ahead and do our own individual little bit of research and put it together. And the power that is thinking and speaking through us, the Vak Shakti, is Saraswati. So Durga, Lakshmi and Saraswati are at play in this. So I guess every task we try to accomplish, it could be a small thing or a big thing, the devis are working with us, through us.
And you're right, Karuna. That's one of the reasons why Navratri is divided into set of 3 days to adore different aspects of the Supreme Goddess. On the first 3 days, the mother is invoked as powerful force called Durga, in order to destroy all our impurities, vices and defects. So when a person acquires triumph over evil tendencies of ego, anger, lust and other animal instincts, he or she experiences a void. And this void is filled with spiritual wealth by Mother Lakshmi. So the next 3 days, the mother is adored as a giver of spiritual wealth, who is considered to have the power of bestowing on her devotees the inexhaustible wealth, both material and spiritual. This is the reason why the 4th, 5th and the 6th day of the Navratri are dedicated to the worship of Lakshmi, the goddess of prosperity and peace. Although the individual has kind of acquired victory over evil tendencies and wealth, he or she is still deprived of true knowledge. So the final set of 3 days is spent in worshipping the mother as the goddess of wisdom, Saraswati, in order to have the all-round success in life. We need the blessings of all the 3 aspects of Divine Mother's power, in fact, to cross everyday hurdles in life. So the 3 forms of the goddess empower us.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Now, let's take this discussion a little deeper. Everything in nature, including all beings, are made up of the 3 gunas of tamas, rajas and sattva. And I understand so are the devis. What does each one represent?
The concept of gunas is that these are qualities or aspects of personality which are inherent within us, in nature and in all of creation. Let's take the tamas guna. The tamo guna represents inertia or passive nature.
And I think it's the most misunderstood guna.
It is the most misunderstood because people generally associate tamas with laziness and with something that is not good to have.
Something dark.
Something dark and not good. What we have to understand is that every aspect of nature is important and has a role to play. And tamo guna has a very important role to play. If we take the example of our own physical bodies, we first have a skeletal structure that defines again our boundaries.
Mm-hmm. And otherwise we would just flow infinitely
exactly.
into the cosmos. I guess we do when we are in the spirit form, but as long as we are in the human experience, we
right.
have our boundaries of the body.
Yes, and if you look at the cells, each cell has a cell wall that defines the boundary of that cell, and that wall is so important for the functioning of that cell,
Absolutely.
For the identity of
Everything
that cell.
Everything in creation has its
That's
boundaries.
Right. And all of these structures that are static, that do not move, are part of the tamoguna. And they are the dense aspect of nature. And this is represented by Mother Durga. When we look at the Rajas Guna, that is passion, enthusiasm, action, vitality. This is the doing aspect of our nature, the Kriya Shakti. And if you look at our bodies, everything that flows in our body, the heart that beats constantly, the blood that flows, all the action that is taking place within ourselves, all of that is the Rajas Guna, the Kriya Shakti, which is symbolized by Mother Lakshmi.
And is always active.
Always active. Mm-hmm. And finally, we come to the Sattva Guna, which people say is the best guna to have. But if you look at our understanding, every guna has a role to play and is important. Sattva guna represents heightened awareness. It is our subtle nature. It represents transcendence and just pure being. And this is Mother Saraswati, who takes us from the doing of Mother Lakshmi to the being. Mm-hmm. And each of these have a role to play. If you take the example of our body, the blood flows. That is the Rajas action, the Rajas Guna. How does the blood know where to flow? That awareness of where to go, that is the Sattva Guna. That's just at a physical level. Of course, you know, when we go to our subtle nature, we get a heightened awareness of all the things around us. And this is what leads us finally to constant integrated awareness. And that is the role of Sattva Guna. And if you look at importance of all these gunas, every guna is important. What is important is not to say that I need this guna or that guna, but to say that I need to balance all the three gunas within me.
So I guess to attain a state of perfection as human beings, or basically divine beings having a human experience, we need to have the three strands in a state of balance. And I can obviously and instantly think of one perfect example of that, and that's our beloved Bhagwan, who was doing all the action, running a huge mission without fanfare, so quietly, but it doesn't mean that he was not active, and he never made a big deal, he did not react. I think one aspect of Sattva Guna is a certain calmness and detachment.
That's right.
And ability to witness events, and I think Bhagwan demonstrated that so beautifully. Whether his projects were flourishing, he was detached, he was just happy. If people were criticizing or condemning, he never reacted. And he went on with his business to bring happiness to mankind, to promote our well-being. So his personality was so perfectly balanced. I guess he is the ultimate real model.
And we also need to understand that it's not a flow, it's not like a linear progression from tamas to rajas to sattva.
No.
It's a cyclical.
And they coexist.
They coexist at all times, that's
yes,
right.
Obviously. Now, let me turn to Lalita. Lalita, in your opinion, how did these energies play out in Bhagwan's life as tangible plans of action?
Well, when you look at Swami's mission, we can see how the Ichha Shakti, the Jnana Shakti and the Kriya Shakti appeared in various forms. For example, as Sai Saraswati, he started his educational institutions, Vidya, you know, giving Vidya is the role that Saraswati plays. And
knowledge.
Interestingly, the pioneer educational institution being a women's campus at Anandpur. Another beautiful thing is how he flung open the doors of Veda Dhyayanam, learning Vedas, to all without any bar of caste or creed or gender or race or region, nothing at all. And another wonderful thing is how he supported and helped the growth of fine arts. Swami's darbar is one of the most majestic ones, most imposing ones. And he's, as they say, you know, Nitya Kalyana Murti, the one who's the embodiment of perpetual auspiciousness. Every moment in his presence was a celebration, is a celebration rather. And how much he encouraged music and dance, he revived religious drama and various traditional art forms like Burakatha, for example. And how, I'm sure all of his sisters would remember how each of us have spent nights making cards, beautiful cards to celebrate each festival and offer to Bhagwan. So all forms of fine arts he encouraged. So that shows the Saraswati aspect of him.
And he also has a music college. We have the Mirpuri College of Music, the Sri Satya Sai Mirpuri College of Music.
Yes, and then as Mother Lakshmi, Saima gifted to the world the temples of learning, those monasteries of healing, and how many times he showered on us gifts galore. And then as Durgama, he gave us the identity. He gave us our strength. And even the structure, as Nirmala Didi was saying, the structure of an organizational setup dedicated to universal well-being and peace, the Satsai organization, the Samiti, that also. So he, being the power, empowered us. So that's one thing. And another thing is, when we look at the celebration of the Navratri festival itself at Prashanti Nilayam, you see an intermingling of the Ichha Shakti, the Jnana Shakti and the Kriya Shakti. You know, when we look at the calendar, the activities that happen during the Navratri celebrations, we find there are three major things. One is the Veda Purusha Saptaha Jnana Yajnam, that is the sacrifice, the ritualistic sacrifice that goes on for 7 days. And another thing is the Prashanti Vidwan Mahasabha. It is the scholarly expositions that go on in the Kulunth Hall in the evening sessions of these days, and various scholars and also the students and staff of Bhagwan's educational institutions, they all deliver lectures. And another activity which simultaneously happens is the Gram Seva program, which Bhagwan so beautifully organized and designed. And another thing is the Ichha behind this Gram Seva program, which symbolizes the Kriya Shakti, was that there is this often quoted incident about how Swami was so moved by the pathetic situation of a mother who suicided because she was unable to feed her children, and the Sai Ma, who is a love of a million mothers, was so moved that Swami decided to send food and clothing to the doorsteps of the villagers.
He sends his students to do this.
Yes. And Avatar who reached out, not just preached, but reached to the doorsteps. So the Veda Purushattah Jnana Yajnam, you know, the...
So many strands of activity are happening simultaneously.
Yes.
The sacrificial fire, the students are all spawning out into the villages and delivering door to door all the goodies from Swami, and as you said, the exposition.
Yes. All, each of it, I think, has got enormous significance. For example, the Yajnam, you know, the Vedic chants which go on, and the sacrificial oblations that are made, you know, every oblation is made with this thought, Idam Namama, meaning whatever be the merit that is accrued of this action, it's not for me. You know, when the Ritvik, the person who is offering, says Idam Namama, the fire god which is taking the oblation also says Idam Namama, and finally it reaches Swami, who is a Veda Purusha himself. And it is not an ordinary yajna, it is Jnana Yajna meant for Loka Kalyanam, as Swami says, the well-being of the entire universe.
And so everybody's saying it's not for me because they're sacrificing that fruit of their
action.
Yes,
for the universal well-being.
Yeah, for a larger cause.
Yes, and just listening to those Vedic chants and being present there itself, you know, purifies our will, our subtle impulses. And I think that is a manifestation of the Ichha Shakti, of the divine Ichha Shakti.
I guess that's why a lot of people just sit during the yajna quietly and just take the energy in and inhale the smoke deeply.
Yes,
coming from the yajna.
Just absorbing Swami's love there.
Although we think we're doing nothing, something is happening within us. Subtle changes are happening. We're transforming.
Really, of course. Another thing is the Jnana Shakti, the Prashanti Vidwan Mahasabha, Shravanam, Mananam and Nididhyasanam, listening and contemplating and finally absorbing it completely. So that happens during the evening sessions of the lectures. And then the Gram Seva is such a mammoth project involving so many people, and you may ask, what is the purpose of it? You know, one day a packet of food and a pair of clothes arrive at a far off home in a village. Will that, you know, remove the hunger and the shortage at that house? Of course it will, because it's reaching there as Swami's prasadam. But there is another aspect to it. You know, Swami is trying to sensitize his children about the rural India, and in fact, you know, poverty and shortage anywhere, so that they take up this seva as an integral part of their daily lives, even when they move out of the university. So he is that way putting us in the path of karma marga, the kriya shakti in him. So I think the Navratri celebrations, as it is in Prashanti Nilayam itself, is a beautiful mingling of these three shaktis.
And I can't imagine a better place in Prashanti for a teenager to grow up, because what a reality check it must be for a young girl or a young boy to go out there and see how people live who have a lot less than us.
It gives a sense of purpose to our life.
And so much of gratitude for what you have. Otherwise, teenagers tend to be always focusing on what they don't have. But when you see how people live and how much that packet of food and the set of clothes and those prasadam from Swami, how much it means to those people and how much joy. I think the very concept of serving, Swami said, it has twofold benefit.
Mm-hmm.
The person who receives the service as well as the one who provides. So apart from the end user, the provider also benefits. And I think there must be a huge growth spurt happening for his children.
And one, you know, really beautiful learning that happens is that the whole thing is so selfless. Swami is the one who is providing, but Swami allows us to work in between. And you know, when we give, he is like a loving mother training us to give. You know, Staitriyam says, Shraddhaya Deyam, how to give. He teaches us how to give.
Give with love, give with humility.
Love, yes, give with faith, Shraddhaya Dayam also. So all that Swami teaches us. And we are also small and tiny, but then He allows us to participate in His, you know, mammoth project.
Truly, Lalita, he's been a real proponent of egalitarian values. In fact, all of his social projects, has a proponent of egalitarian value, how he has brought in these things into our conscience too.
Otherwise, you know, this is such a perfect model. Nobody thought how quietly Swami did, but everything is incorporated in it.
Yeah, true.
And this is true education for life. Because the child who is going to go to the village for 10 days in a year is not going to forget that experience for their entire life.
And you know, those of us who, as Anandpur girls, we have sat and packed the whole night, and you know, every packet is suffused with love, packed with Swami's name, and the entire atmosphere is one of joy and, you know, namasmarana. So the whole process from the packing to the, you know, loading the crates and then going to the villages, I'm sure the whole thing, you know, is one of selfless love and, you know, giving and giving the way Swami was.
Oh, how I wish, you know, the Indian Parliament had a Gram Seva service. Imagine what it would do to the hearts of our leaders and our representatives. Total transformation. For once, they would know the people who vote them to power, their constituents, what their lives are like. Not just on the day you go on a rally and ask for elections. India is headed for major elections in a few months' time. And just imagine if our parliamentarians, our leaders, they just experience something as selfless as what Swami has set up here.
They'll be really touching the pulse of the nation then.
I know.
And the pulse of your own being as well.
Conscience.
Yes.
Because I think it would make them ponder over their sense of accountability to the people who give them the vote and throw their weight behind them.
That's right.
I know. It's just incredible what all happens in Puttaparthi and how quietly it happens. Nirmala Sekhar, you have a background in accountancy and business. In your opinion, is there a correlation between the symbolism of Navratri and capitalism?
I'm reminded of what Devdutt Patnaik, the famous mythologist, how he explained the role of Durga Lakshmi Saraswati in our modern day economy. He equates Mother Durga to the EQ aspect within us, the emotional quotient, by giving us that boundary, that identity, and the emotional security. We also get a chance to be validated by ourselves and by others, and that improves, you know, we feel emotionally very secure. And nowadays, modern companies just focus on the profit line, Mother Lakshmi, the bottom line, the profitability, and how much can I make with this product, with the service. However, if the modern companies and the economy could focus on Mother Durga and Saraswati, then that would be a much more wholesome development of the companies and the economy. Even for Mother Lakshmi, he describes the two aspects of Mother Lakshmi. People all over India worship Mother Lakshmi as Sri Devi and Bhu Devi. And he explains that Sri Devi represents personal wealth, whereas Bhu Devi represents universal natural wealth. And today, when Mother Nature is being plundered, literally plundered, this concept of developing Bhu Devi, the universal natural wealth, is so important.
Absolutely. While our rivers are being polluted, our forests are being denuded, this is what we need to have, heightened awareness.
That's right. And if you look at Mother Saraswati, if a company could focus on creativity, research, development, innovation, that becomes then a truly knowledge economy. And any company that focuses on all these aspects of EQ, personal and universal wealth, and creativity and knowledge economy, not just within themselves as employees, but also for their customers, then that's definitely a wholesome and a long-term growth for the company and for the economy as well.
I can't help but think of one poster boy, the Oracle of Omaha, Mr. Warren Buffett. I think he has his three energies very well aligned.
That's right.
Now, while we are discussing the divine trinity of Devi individually, Bhagwan has simplified this seemingly complex subject, making it so easy for us to approach it. Dr. Sharda Subramaniam, would you care to share with our listeners what it is?
Yeah, you're right, Karuna. Bhagavan often says there is no need to propitiate Durga, Lakshmi or Saraswati for energy, material prosperity and knowledge. He says, in fact, if we love and adore our physical mother, we shall be showing our love and our devotion to all the goddesses. In fact, the role of the mother is so very important that he very often speaks about three great and important mothers who have really created three great masters in the history of the world. And he speaks about, oh, those three great personalities are Gandhi, Abraham Lincoln and Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar. And Gandhi, in fact, admits that his strongest formative influence was his mother, Putlibai. And she was his ideal and role model too. And he says her love and saint-like resolve and the iron will left an indelible imprint on him, and that owing to her, his image of the women perceived by him was one of love and sacrifice. It is said that from his mother, he inherited the maternal love and the techniques of self-suffering, which really brought him to the title of Mahatma through the proposal or the project of Satyagraha. Similarly, Swami spoke very high about the mother of Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar, that is Bhagavati Devi, who had nourished a very noble desire, and when her son was willing to gift her with lot of lovely things, what she asked for was a school for the village which did not have a proper schooling, a well for the village and a hospital for the village. And this reminds me of how noble Ishwaramma also had this.
Absolutely.
And it was her noble desire which led Bhagwan to plunge into all these social activities. I'm sure, of course, Bhagwan had the will, but then he made Ishwaramma the instrument for bringing in this kind of a transformation.
You're very right, and I think every hero, be he an avatar or a lesser than an avatar, every hero or a heroine in the world has a strong mother behind, because we know that Mother Ishwaramba did not have an easy journey. She had her own dilemma, being the mother of the divine, and she had to bear the burden of being the avatar's mother. At the same time, she had to reconcile her fate with her son's destiny. And then in the end, I think she just ended up sacrificing her personal dreams for her son, who was born for a greater purpose. So that made her not only mother to the avatar, but mother to humanity.
You're right.
Without her support and without her unflinching faith that what he's doing, he has his own life to live, much as she wanted him to settle down like all her other children, get married and have a family and live in his little home, she had to accept the fact that Bhagwan would embrace the whole world as his family. And she just joined the movement as a devotee towards the end.
And she had to share her son with the entire world.
Yes. Mm. And you know, most moms are very possessive of their children. And in India, Indian moms tend to be extra possessive of their sons. But this was a very noble mother who gladly, eventually, shared her son because she knew he had a greater purpose to fulfill. And despite being a very simple woman of no particular education, she was smart and intelligent enough to foresee that he had a greater role to play in the destiny of humanity. And that takes inner knowledge, not book knowledge, to recognize that. Now, culturally, we have always placed the mother on a pedestal. So let's demystify our understanding of motherhood. Who is a mother? What qualifies one to be a mother? Is it only a biological mother, or does motherhood extend beyond?
Karuna, my understanding is that motherhood is not just a role, but it is an inherent nurturing aspect within all of us, man and woman. If you take a 5-year-old that is teaching a 2-year-old how to use a play or a game, that is the mothering instinct in the 5-year-old at that point in time.
And does it matter if the 5-year-old is a boy or a girl?
It doesn't matter, because I think each one of us is gifted with that mothering instinct. It's up to us to develop it and acknowledge its existence and give it a chance to bloom and blossom. Even as we respect our physical mother, let's not forget that
there are so many different people who have had a mothering role in our lives at different points in time. There's a saying, it takes a village to raise a child. And if we look back at our life, I'm sure that all of us can acknowledge and understand the different people who have played that mothering role in our life at different points in time. And if you also look at the aspect, you know, just mothering being nurturing of our physical self, of our intellectual abilities, mothering also plays a very important role in the nurturing of our human values, the inherent wealth of character that is within us.
I think what Didi told is very important, because just now, as Sharadam was saying about the great role the mothers played in the lives of Lincoln and Mahatma Gandhi and also Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar, just as behind every great leader, there's a great mother. Behind every person who perpetrates some sort of crime, once upon a time, he too was a baby in his mother's arm.
Mm-hmm.
So if values could be instilled at the most formative time, nothing like that. I think that's why some would have stressed the Bal Vikas programs and education and human values programs with such great emphasis. Because, you know, it is mentoring to mothering that is involved as far as a guru is concerned.
And this is a beautiful...
If I recollect, the first discourse which Bhagwan gave in Anantapur campus, he said he started this campus to tend good mothers.
Yes.
And because Swami knew that if he educates a mother, he's educating an entire family. And at a later time, when Bhagwan was asked by some students, what can we do to please you, Swami? And he said, you can do just one thing. You don't have to do something really grandiose, bombastic. Just raise good children. So mothering is a very important role, and we all are mothers as Bal Vikas gurus, as aunts, as sisters, as moms as well, and grandmothers. And it's definitely not, as I understand, limited to being a biological mother.
Definitely not. But let's also not forget two other important mothers that we have. The first one, and I think most people tend to ignore this aspect, is that each one of us is a mother to ourselves, and we have a role to play in mothering ourselves. And how can that be possible is when we truly understand and accept ourselves unconditionally, when we love ourselves unconditionally as mothers love their children, that's when we mother ourselves. And we don't have to depend on somebody outside to do that, give us that gift of unconditional love. We can do it for ourselves. The most important mother that all of us can relate to is our Divine Sai Ma, who nurtures us at every step. And what is more important, I think all of us have that experience, is that Swami cherishes our simplest achievements. And that's something that really touches me, that aspect of Divine Mother cherishing something very insignificant.
And also, he was such a forgiving mother. You know, when the toddler learns to walk, he might fall down 100 times, but finally when he walks and reaches the mother is not going to tell how many times you fell, but is simply going to embrace him with all her love. So that was the way Swami was. How many ever times we faltered and fell, but he just embraced us, you know, unconditionally the moment
he
reached him.
And he celebrated our small achievements, and he made us look so good to the outside world. Sometimes it was almost embarrassing.
That's right.
You're right, Karuna. This reminds me of an experience when Bhagwan came to Anantapur campus, and all of us were very busy decorating the prayer hall, the dining hall, and almost all the areas available. And then he had got a lot of guests along with him. And as he entered the prayer hall, actually we had made a very, very simple decoration with festoons and balloons and things like that. And then as he entered, he just showed those decorations to his, the people whom he had got along with him. And then he said, look, these are the things which my children have made. And he was making us proud for actually doing nothing much.
And I remember actually, when I think back, it was almost like a 5-year-old child's birthday party, the way we had decorated the prayer hall.
Right.
Because at short notice,
yes,
there wasn't much we could do. So there were just these streamers and balloons. And imagine, that was a decoration for receiving the Lord of the Universe, but he made such a big deal about it. And
you're right.
I remember that instance. Yes, that was Swami all the time. I remember how he would praise us to outsiders, although sometimes he wasn't so giving when he was having a private session with us. He would pull us up for small mistakes. But when it came to others, he would always speak very highly of us. And he celebrated each of our little achievements, starting with those tiny cards, those cards with all kinds of streamers hanging out of them and beads and little glitter glue on them. And how he adored them is just a piece of construction paper we had used.
Another thing that I remember is the way he reminded us to worship our parents. I remember it was in 2005, October 5th afternoon, and Swami had called us for an interview. And in the interview, Swami asked us whether we want anything. And all of us in unison shouted, "Swami, we want you." And then, you know, very facetiously, he shook his head as if, you know. And then he asked, "Isn't it cold? Shall I send you all blankets?" And then he said, "No, Swami." And then he asked, "Do you want books, pens?" Again, we replied together, "No, Swami, we just wanted him." And then, you know, Swami paused and Swami asked, "I want something." Now, you know, it is like the roles are reversed and we are very, very excited. And we said, "Yes, Swami." You know, he just has to ask and we'll give him. And then Swami said, "Make your parents happy." You know, and that has become such a cornerstone for many of us, because making our parents happy is all that he wanted from us. So as a wonderful cosmic mother, he reminded us that we have to adore our parents. Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava.
I think that's a lifelong lesson, and if you sort of abide by it, most of your life's problems get solved. I think most complications arise when we have difficulty in relationships. And Swami, and a lot of people spend half of their adult life maybe going to shrink, seeking advice, resolving psychological baggage because they have issues growing up and relating to maybe their parents. But Swami resolved it for us so early in life by telling us to keep it simple, clean and loving. Now, Lalita Sarma, in your opinion, what qualities make the feminine paramount in creation?
You know, the Bhagavad Gita says, "Kirti Shrir Vak Cha Narinam Smritir Medha Dhriti Kshama," meaning fame, auspiciousness, soft speech, memory, intelligence, fortitude and patience are the virtues, you know, that are remarkable in a woman. Now, if you observe keenly, all these are not restricted to women. These are qualities that are as well present in a man. So, I think every individual is androgynous in nature. There is the masculine and the feminine energy in all of us. I have a very interesting and personal experience to relate in this point.
Please do.
When I was doing my MPhil program, I was working on three authors, since I'm from literature background, Doris Lessing, Anita Desai and Virginia Woolf. And I was working on this particular chapter on Virginia Woolf, and I was looking at her as an androgynous writer.
So this is the famous British novelist?
Yes, yes. As I was working, it was quite late in the night, and with the laptop on my lap, I fell asleep. And in my dream, Swami came and told me that all that I had typed out, the chapter that I had just finished composing seemingly, was irrelevant. He told me my understanding of androgyny is completely wrong. And then Swami went on to give a beautiful three-tier structure of androgyny. And Swami told how androgyny is firstly within the individual. Swami told there is this masculine and the feminine within us, the rational and the emotional aspects, and that has to be balanced. And secondly, Swami told that in interpersonal relationship, there has to be balance of the androgyny. And, you know, he gave the example of himself saying, "As Krishna, I served my consorts." And then he told how Gandhiji nursed Kasturba. And then also Swami gave, Swami told in the dream that when Emperor Harishchandra lost everything because he stood for truth, it seems he wept like a baby. And his wife, Queen Chandramati, told him that he's an emperor, he has to be brave and should not succumb to the test. And it is Chandramati who, you know, showed courage, that masculine aspect, when Emperor Harishchandra became weak. So Swami was showing me examples of how it is not the masculine and the feminine energies are not necessarily restricted to the male or female beings.
They're not exclusive. They coexist.
Even this, Swami told that this balance of the masculine and feminine has to be there even when it is a relation between a man and another man, or a woman and another woman. It's not necessarily across the gender also.
So all relationships.
All relationships.
We have to seek a balance.
Yes, complementing each other.
Emotional and rational.
Emotional and rational. And the next one, the third tier that Swami spoke was that of the macro level. You know, Swami was saying how the war instinct and the peace instinct are the masculine and the feminine. And then Swami was saying how if the feminine aspect of nurturing and healing is given greater attention in the macro level, then we will be moving towards the world peace. You know, and even Swami was saying about that year's Nobel Peace winners. We had the three Nobel Peace Prize winners of 2011, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Lema Roberta Govey, and Tawakkul Karman for their nonviolent struggle for the safety of women and especially for women's rights to full participation in peace building work. So women have a great role to contribute.
Somebody told you all this.
Yes. And this is one important thing that I feel, the balance of the feminine and the masculine. We have to acknowledge the feminine in us, whether you are a man or a woman, and we have to let that nurturing aspect come out.
What about Virginia Woolf? Did he comment on your essay on her?
Yes, you know, I had started working on Virginia Woolf, presuming that she was an androgynous writer. That was the way I was analyzing the novels, you know, and Swami told me how Woolf is not at all an androgynous writer. That was like a shock to me. And then Swami told how she was an extremely feminine writer and she was seeking balance. You know, the writer herself creates, you know, seeks that inner harmony. So she was trying to put into practice this androgyny, the concept of androgyny.
So through her writing?
Through her writing.
What an insight.
Yes, Swami gave me that insight about this particular author.
So then you had to redo your...
I did redo the whole chapter, you know, following Swami's guidance in that.
And I think that one thing that you said is so pertinent, that the rise of the feminine energy would lead to more peace. And I think if there's ever a time in the history of humanity where we need a rise in the feminine energy across genders, across relationships, it is now.
It is now.
We are in such turmoil and difficulty. I think
need both inner and outer balance.
Exactly.
And, you know, spirituality is all about balance. So I think this is really, as you are telling, the cusp moment, no? A transition moment.
Yeah, we are on a threshold of a new age, and the more we nurture the feminine consciousness within ourselves and recognize it in each other, the better the chances of our survival as a race.
And it's a really a very beautiful insight, Lalita. It really helps us to understand that Navratri is not just affirming the feminine nature, but also the balance of masculine and feminine nature within us, within our relationships, and also in the macrocosm.
Yes, yes.
Ladies, I want to thank you for your wisdom and the insights, which were tremendously incisive and path-breaking, I should say. And I think we should, the best way we can conclude this study circle is to hope and pray that all of us and all our listeners are able to incorporate the learnings that we have received through this exercise and experience the spiritual growth within ourselves and find our balance. We all somehow seem to be tipped off the balance, to find the right balance of between rationality and emotionality and between the yin and yang, the Prakriti and Purusha, so that we nurture the part that needs the nurturing that has often been neglected, which is the feminine consciousness. And now that I have you on the spot, maybe I can place a request, because I know you won't be able to say no to the listeners. Perhaps we should have more such sessions going forward.
Yes, Swami.
Thank you, Karuna.
That would be fantastic. And I didn't hear a yes from Nirmala.
This is this kind of study circle is something that really helps us to reflect ourselves.
Yes, it rather helps us more.
Yeah.
To get the ideas
clear.
That's what I was going to say, that you gave us a good platform to learn.
Because I wanted an easy way to learn myself and help the listeners too. So I invited all of you wonderful ladies who have such good understanding of Swami's teachings. And it's been great learning for myself and I'm sure for our listeners.
Yeah, it's an endeavor to learn.
And it's an ongoing process. Swami's wisdom is like an infinite ocean. So every now and then if we can grab a drop of it, it's just perfect. Thank you very much for your participation and appreciate your commitment and to all the struggle we went through to get this thing recorded.
To get the power.
The power. This is empowering from within, not empowering, because we roughed it out till the power was restored, because, dear listeners, Andhra Pradesh, the part of Andhra Pradesh that we are located in, is experiencing severe power cuts right now. So we spent a day without any power waiting for this moment when we could record this, and appreciate your company and appreciate your listening to this program, and we look forward to your feedback. Thank you all, and holy happy Navratri to everyone.
Thank you so much, Karuna.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Om Shri Sai Ram. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories, a series of conversations with the former students of Bhagwan Baba schools and colleges. Our guest today is Mrs. Yogini Suvarna from Mumbai. Yogini Suvarna is an alumna of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, and she came to Baba's fold right from the time of her birth. Yogini schooled at Mumbai's Kanosa High School. She also completed 9 years of the Bal Vikas and Pre-Sevadal program from Mumbai. From grade 11 onwards, she joined the Sri Satya Sai Junior College at Anantpur, and she went on to earn 2 degrees from the Sri Satya Sai University Anantpur campus. She earned a BSc in Physics as well as a Bachelor's degree in Education. Thereafter, Yogini got herself a Master's degree in Education from the University of Mumbai. Yogini is musically talented and one of the lead bhajan singers in Mumbai, and she has also led bhajans at the Anantpur campus during her student days and continues to contribute to the Akhand Bhajans in Prashanti Nilayam. She is also a bhajan coordinator in Mumbai and teaches bhajan singing to Balvika students there. Being an educator, she is the Maharashtra coordinator and trainer for the Sri Satya Sai Vidya Vahini program. Yogini is a mother of 2 young sons, both of whom are studying in Bhagwan schools right here in Prashanti Nilayam. Sai Ram, Yogini, and welcome to Fleeting Moments.
Sai Ram Nidhi.
Yogini, let's start with your journey to Swami. I understand it began with the miracle right at your birth.
Yes.
What happened?
My mother was in the 8th month of her pregnancy. I was to be that baby. In all the previous checkups done in the hospital, the feedback given to her by the doctors there was that the child in the womb has not developed well, as it should have in those particular months. Those days there was no sonography. And even in her 7th month ceremony, the ceremony that we have in the family as a function, all the relatives commented on, you know, the size of her stomach. Usually 7th month, mother is quite big. So my parents, listening to all this feedback from the doctors and the relatives' comments, they were a bit tensed, quite worried, in fact. Now, the date of the delivery was coming close, and my mother decided to go to her native place in Mangalore. That's her maternal home, to deliver.
From Mumbai?
Yeah, from Mumbai, to deliver the baby. So they were waiting at the Santa Cruz airport, the domestic terminal. They had to take an early morning 9:30 a.m. flight. Now, an announcement was made, and they said that the flight would leave at 12:30 now. It was delayed. So my parents were waiting in the waiting lobby. They saw at that time Indira Devi coming to the same place, the launch. Indira Devi.
The lady, the yoga lady.
Yes.
One of the earliest Western devotees of Baba.
Yes, yes. This was somewhere, I think, in June, July, the incident that happened at the airport. In May, they had seen her, so my father has also read a book about her, so they immediately recognized her, and they went up to her. She said she has just arrived from Puttaparthi after having Swami's darshan. Now, they recognized her, and then they went up to her just to say Sai Ram. Now, she looked at my mother, and she said, "You have a health problem." She doesn't know my parents. She said, "I have a Japamala created by Swami, and he has said that if the person who has health problems held it in his hand, then he would get cured." So she gave the Japamala to my mother, and my mother held it with cupped hands, and she also touched it to the stomach, you know, with the babies. Then she also took out a little box, which she said Swami has given to her. It has Akshaya Vibhuti, Vibhuti that does not get over at all.
She gave this a little vibhuti to my parents at that time to have. And she took out a little bit of paper and put some vibhuti in that. And she told my mother, at the time of delivery, you take this again. That was it. Then my parents went to Mangalore. After a few days, when the next checkup time was there, my parents went to the doctor there in Mangalore. The doctors checked and said that everything is just normal. Now this
nothing
was
to worry about
nothing
anymore.
To worry about it anymore.
In 1 month, everything had changed.
Yes. The doctors in Mangalore just said everything was just normal. And even the delivery happened smoothly. And the only thing that when I was born was my right foot was a bit bent up. But doctors said that that's a normal phenomena with, you know, the child cramped up in the womb. A little plaster. For 3 months, my right leg had to be in plaster.
Well, he had many projects in mind for you, so he cured you in time because he had much work for you to do. And then I understand your childhood days were spent with Swami being the center stage of your life and that of your parents.
Yes, yes.
This was mostly in Mumbai, I'm guessing.
It was both in Mumbai and Parthi. Uh-huh. All my vacations, the place of my vacations was Parthi. Somehow Swami had it in mind for me that either I'm in Mumbai or I'm in Parthi. My parents used to get both of us.
So did you not ever go to, like, people go to sea resorts or hill stations for their holidays? You always came to Puttaparthi?
Yes. Actually, if you see, during those days, the concept of hill stations and all has come maybe more towards the after 80s, 90s. Then there was either you stay at home or you go to your native place. Mm-hmm. At least for us, it was like that. Mm-hmm. But we had only one native place, that is Parthi. So my parents, they waited for our vacations to begin. The next day, we had the ticket and all four of us, my parents and me and my younger sister, we would all be straight on the train to Parthi. And if you remember Parthi during those days, 1974 or 75, my mother said I was 1.5 when I came to Parthi first. That would have been 75. We had to come up to Dharmavaram station, railway station. And then there were no autos then. So we had to take the horse tonga.
It was called Jatka.
Jatka.
Yes.
The tonga ride. And we had to go to the bus station in that rickety, have a tonga ride. But we as kids used to love that. We never knew any vacation other than this. This was really our vacation. The only thing was the heat. The place was very hot. AP was very hot. Even now it is. Maybe then it was more.
I think it was hotter then. It has really cooled off now.
Yes.
By comparison.
Yes. It is a bit more greener now. It used to be dry then. And then the rickety bus ride, the state transport buses all the way to Parthi. But all these things didn't matter. And we had to carry lots of luggage. Because here we had to stay. There was only one Ganesh shed. There was nothing else. The mandir. And then near Ganesh temple, on the left-hand side, if you face Ganesha, there used to be a Ganesh shed. And the devotees would come and stay there. So I remember my parents carrying mats, blankets, if it was winter, so many bed sheets. For four of us, we had lots of luggage. And also my mother used to carry a stove because we were little at that time, you know, for boiling milk. Food we would have in some hotel outside the ashram. But she would carry a few utensils and stove. And I remember even bucket for bath. There would be no bathroom inside then. We had to go outside. There were mats tied and we used to have bath there. And also my mother said that we would go to the Chitravati Road either to have bath or to wash all the clothes, you know. So these were those days. This is my parents' memory. I don't remember these days because I was really small. I remember the days when the other sheds had come up, you know, after the Ganesh shed, there were the other sheds which had come up. There were no west buildings at that time. So then afterwards I have memories of staying in the W1234 or whatever. So
did you as a child have opportunities to have an interaction with Baba?
Yes, darshan was the most powerful interaction actually. If you see, that is more than enough.
Right.
We don't need, because there was no hustle bustle, there was no jostling for darshan. You just came and you just sat on the sands. There were no arches also at that time. It was a white compound wall, you know. I just still remember with those lotus flowers.
In between.
Yes, and we were little children. We were never allowed on the first line. So even if mother got the first line, we had to, you know, in between two ladies, we had to push ourselves to have darshan of Swami. and the sands would be so hot in summer. And
afternoon darshan
yes,
was tough.
Yes.
And it was very early, so you had to come out and line up at 3:34 under the blazing sun.
Yes, yes. So either it was so hot or sometimes it would be raining and nobody would get up and go anywhere. There was nowhere to go because there was just open space everywhere. And I remember days when you're just sitting and waiting for Swami to come. Swami had not yet come and it would be raining. And you know, you're getting drenched. The water is soaking through your clothes and it's flowing down. You can see water flowing down everywhere. But no devotee is budging. There must be just 4 or 5 lines of devotees at that time. Maximum 6 lines, 7 lines. It was not more than that. And then the rain would subside and Swami would come. And he would be totally dry and we would all be nicely drenched. It was a beautiful feeling. These are my strong memories of childhood because I was small. So these are some strong memories that have remained in my mind. Either it's the rain or it's the hot sun. You can't sit. You're getting baked from down. And then also I remember Swami walking. There was no music being played. Only the birds, you know, chirping of the birds.
And during Swami would darshan, come.
Yes,
very quiet,
yeah, very
yes.
quiet. There was no music at all. Swami would come, he would just walk around. He would come from the mandir itself, right? He used to live in the mandir. Walk around and then he would look, he would interact, he would take letters, he would stand sometimes, talk. So many times I've had the opportunity of him standing just in front of me and just staring at him from there. You take namaskar, sometimes he creates vibhuti. One day my mother said this incident that we were really small and we were sitting with my father on the gent side. And the lady next to her, Swami created vibhuti for her. And my mother in her mind told Swami, I wish my children were with me. Because he was putting the remaining vibhuti after he gave that lady to the little children around. He was putting it for them on their forehead. So she was just thinking, I wish my 2 children were with me, then Swami would have put for them. And she did not know that Swami just walked to the other side. She does not know where my father is sitting. With my father, we both were there, me and my younger sister. Again, he created vibhuti for someone else there and he did the tilak of vibhuti for both of us.
Oh, he read her mind.
The same day.
Same day.
Yes.
So
was,
blessed.
That was a beautiful incident. And also he has done the Om Akshara on the slate for both of us.
Still to initiate
yes,
into spiritual
I still
learning.
Have it, yes.
I see. And that worked well for you because you went through the entire Bal Vikas program.
Entire. Actually, my parents wanted Bal Vikas to start in our own house because the Bal Vikas class was very, very far and it was difficult to take us and get back again in Mumbai. So they decided since we were 2 and there were a few kids in our apartments where we stayed. So they started the class, both of them. At that time, you did not have all these training sessions and all that, all these formal procedures. You just found out what the syllabus was and you started teaching. So they both were my first Bal Vikas gurus too.
Mom
my parents,
Dad.
Yes. And we had the whole lot of kids, our own friends whom we played with during the daytime. All those kids would come for Bal Vikas and we would have the entire drawing room used to be filled with the kids. And I just remember my parents, you know, all the din and the noise and the quiet and the prayers and the bhajans, loud bhajans with music, you know. The entire childhood days have been spent like this. My entire schooling days started Bal Vikas at 6 years and completed it after 9 years with the pre-seva dal. This was it. Every Saturday, group 1, group 2, and on Sunday we had group 3 of the Bal Vikas. Our weekends would just go in doing Bal Vikas.
So Yogini, you went to a modern high school in Mumbai. And yet at home, everything around you was filled with Sai awareness. You were soaking in that environment. Did you at any point in time as a young teenager feel a conflict of interest, the peer pressure, the draws of the world on one side and the path that Bal Vikas was laying on the other side, a path of righteousness and truth and simplicity and humility and moderation? Was there a difficult time you were torn?
Actually, by Swami's grace, the conflict was hardly ever there. Because the school in which I was studying, it was a Christian missionary school, a convent school. It was called Kanosa Convent School. We had nuns teaching us, sisters teaching us. So the Christians had the religion class and we had the moral class. So the classes would get divided. And the songs that we would sing, the assemblies that would happen. And through the day, the atmosphere had no conflict, even within our friends. Maybe the media didn't come in then. So life moved not at the pace as it is moving right now. It was much slower and quieter then.
Mm-hmm. And then you made a choice to come to Anandpur.
Yes. Before that, I would like to narrate one small incident from my school days.
Please do.
My school, Kanusa, is on the way to Dharmakshetra, where Swami comes. It is barely 5 minutes walk from Dharmakshetra. So, I do not remember which standard I was. Swami used to come to Dharmakshetra almost twice a year, regularly, every year, in May and in December. Now, this must have been the December visit. And it was his last day and he had to go back to Parthi. Now, if he has to pass, he has to pass by my school. And the school gate is just adjoining the road, which he has to take to go to the airport. So my father had told me that most likely after the morning darshan and bhajans, he will be going by at your first break time, when you have your first break. So see that you come and stand at the gate and don't miss a moment of the break, because he might pass by just at that time and you'll get a close darshan. So I was there waiting for the first break bell to ring, because yes, Swami is going to pass by my school. And I ran and I stood at the gate with my tiffin box. The whole entire 15 minutes I was just staring outside the gate. All the other kids I could see at the back of me were screaming, playing, the normal break time, how it is. And I was stuck at the gate waiting outside. Swami didn't come. The break bell rang. All the kids had to go back inside. There was a captain who was sending there. Maybe she was a 9th or 10th standard student who was sending all the kids inside. Now she saw I was standing at the gate looking outside. I kept looking at her because I was smaller. I knew she would call me any moment. She gestured to me to come. I thought, let me have one last look before I go. I just turned to look and his car came.
Mm-hmm.
There was no one else here. All the other school kids had gone in.
Inside.
And she also went in. She told, come, and she went in. I was the only person at the school gate looking outside. And his car glided and came. It's so fresh, like a video. It's playing in my mind as I'm talking to you now. And there Swami was on my side of the window, you know, this side. He didn't look at me, but that was more than enough for me. That was a confirmation of, you know, his knowing that, yes, this girl is here. And he made the atmosphere so beautiful, you know, the quiet and all came in.
You had your one-on-one
darshan.
Yes. Beautiful. Oh my God. You must have been a little girl. Oh God, that would be a very powerful experience at that age.
Yes. Yes.
Lovely.
I must have been around 8 or 9 year old. We had an exhibition in Dharmakshetra. Swami was in Dharmakshetra and it was a Balvikas exhibition wherein each Balvikas class had put up some model or chart, and all this was displayed in Shantideep. There's a big hall in Dharmakshetra. It's a huge rectangular hall. So along the periphery of the hall, all the models were placed. And I was unaware of it. There's another Jalan Mandap down. It's an open place and when Swami comes, they put a pandal so that all the devotees can sit there. Many devotees can be seated there. So I was seated down with the rest of the Balvikas children. Now, after some time, some of us were handpicked. You know, you come like that. Some of us were handpicked and we were taken on top to go to Shantideep where the exhibition was to be. And then they told us to stand one at each of the models. And they told us what you have to explain about this model when Swami comes. I was one of them. Now, where I was standing, my model was placed, was at the end of the hall. After some time, as I was rehearsing in my mind what I have to tell Swami when he comes, one of the elders, he came up to me and he called me. And then he took me there at the place where Swami would enter. And there were 2-3 of them elders. They called 2 children. Then they sent one girl back and they retained me. And he told me, when Swami comes, you have to give him the bouquet of flowers. I was at the end of the hall. The hall had so many Balvikas children. He does not know me. I'm just some 8-9 year old kid. I still have the photograph in the white and white Balvikas with 2 chotis, 2 plaits. And then, it's not that it's a very great incident, but I'm just looking at it, how he has tapped on me in those early days. All these small tappings that he has done have left a very big impact, as I see it now. I was waiting there with the bouquet, waiting for him. And you know how it is when people are in anticipation of Swami to arrive. And he had to climb a flight of stairs and he had to come up. He came up as usual, holding the robe in his hand, and he entered. Even these are some of the very strong memories I have of Swami of my early days. He came, he straight looked into my eyes, and I just went forward, gave him the flower and took a namaskar. But this is a very beautiful memory that I have, that he picked me from so many of them. There were two of them finally, and still I was the one that was chosen. I have definitely seen his hand playing in my life from quite an early time. In fact, since I've told you, it's from birth. But there were incidents where he has left such a huge impact. There's no going back, you know. There's no going back once such things happen in your life. There's another small incident during my Balvikas days itself. This was in another visit of Swami to Mumbai, where a huge number of children, I don't remember what's the number, at least 200, 250 plus children, I guess, we had put up a dance ballet in the Vallabhai Patel Stadium in Mumbai. I must have been around 9, 10 year old. And we were all stars, and there were these bigger Prisevadal boys who had become planets, and they had entered those huge round structures which looked like planets, and they had to do the spinning. And we had our dance music where the stars are moving around the planet. Swami would be seated on the stage and watching all this.
And the audience are on the stage?
Swami was on the stage watching, and we were all spread in the stadium. It's a huge area.
Oh, I see.
Area.
Okay.
It's a huge area. Swami was on the stage.
In the big stadium, yes. Understood.
We were displaying it. It was a night function.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no lights anywhere. All the lights were off. And we were stars, and we had on our palms, you know, these battery-operated lights.
Yeah. So you were all glittering and glowing in the night.
We were flickering the lights, and the planets were turning down. There was nice music which matched the planet and the stars, and Swami was watching from the stage while the program was going on. There was one particular step in the dance where we had to kneel down and take a particular Bharatanatyam kind of pose, where you have to twist your leg behind and hold it with your hand. So I had to twist my right leg behind and hold it with my hand. Now when I sat in the pose, I have done this umpteen number of times, very comfortably. There, when the program was going on, I sat in that pose and I got a muscle pull. And I was in pain, and it was paining so much. But I did not want to move, though I was just one amongst the more than 100 or 200 stars, you know, dancing in front of Swami.
And nobody would have noticed.
But I was small then, and I did not know whether anybody would notice. So I did not want to move at all. And I sent a prayer, a strong prayer to Swami. Swami, before the music changes, please see that this goes away so that I can get up. And all the while the pull was on, you know, for the few seconds at which I had to remain in that position. And so beautifully, the moment that music changed and all the children got up, even I could easily get up and run, you know, to the next position. This was something very small, but it was so important to me at that time. You know, that one-to-one connection that you tell Swami something and he does it for you. He responds, and he responds immediately. That confirmation he gave with this incident, which is very important in our life. When you get the response immediately, you know that you can do it another time and it is successful.
He's always listening. We don't remember that, but it just proves that Swami is always listening to everything that's going on in our heart, everything we pray for.
Yes.
So let's talk about your choice of college. You chose Anandpur after studying till grade 10 in Mumbai.
Yes. Actually, my parents, especially my father, he was the big inspiration for me from day one for Anandpur. I remember very clearly the hill at which we have the ad block right now, the institute. There was nothing there before. And we used to go mountain hiking, you know. I told you from 75 we've been there, and the university has come in later, around 5-6 years later. So we used to do our hiking on that, you know. There was a water rickshaw over there, and we would sit and meditate and just go about in the mountain. There was nothing much over there. And then my father started telling, see, here they are going to build an ad block. A university will come up here. Oh, what is a university? And for me, a small child, did not make much of a sense. But then I remember very clearly, even now, seeing the mud path being laid to go up to the university. There was a mud path. There were these trucks coming and taking all the building material. Then the road came in. Then the university came in. And during every of those days, Swami almost every day would go up. And we would be waiting there, you know, a few of us. There were not many people. We would be waiting in different points along the path where Swami would be coming. And we would every day catch car darshan, you know, on the way up or on the way down. Sometimes he would get off the car and talk to some of us. I remember my mother getting a pad namaskar during one such thing. He just got off the car. He was talking to a few of us. And then she went and took a pad namaskar. And it's an amusing incident, but I must say here. He said in Hindi when she was taking the namaskar, koi koi to udhari so jata hai.
Referring to what?
Yeah, that's what. We didn't understand.
People just sleep there.
Yeah, sleep there. So my mother told later that when she does the namaskar at home every day, she imagines Swami standing in front of her. And also she takes, you know, pradakshina for Ganesh, this, that, and eventually she falls asleep while doing the namaskar.
in her mind.
Yeah.
So he was just confirming her mental exercise.
Yeah. In her mind she does all this. So it takes quite a lot of time. And then sometimes she falls asleep over there.
Yeah.
So then he told, koi koi to udhari so jata hai when she took the namaskar.
Namaskar. What a nice confirmation though.
Yes, it's a big confirmation that he was actually standing there for her namaskars and he must have gotten bored.
Yeah. I also read somewhere that Swami said, why are you always jostling for my namaskar in the darshan? Because in your heart you can have as many namaskars as you want.
Yes.
Without having to vie for attention.
That's where my father would always tell, when the university comes, you have to go to Anandpur. Just look at the Anandpur girls. He would always draw my eyes to see the girls going up and down. See how they are behaved. See, they are so lucky. They are studying. So I had no other inspiration, but I have to study here. I didn't have any other choice. I didn't even think of applying in Mumbai. So I didn't actually, Swami made things easy for me by just giving me one choice. He did not give me two, three things to choose.
Too many choices only confuse you, I think.
Yeah, he made the choice for me. Now here, now here, now there. Mm-hmm. It was like that.
Mm-hmm. So you did your BSc Physics and B.Ed, Bachelor's Degree in Education. That is about 4 years you spent. And also 2 years prior.
Yes, 6 years.
So 6 years you were a Sci student here.
Yes.
What are your fondest memories of those 6 years?